want to thank everyone for coming. These are interesting times we're in, and I woke up not too long ago and thought, you know, we have, and I'm always bragging upon the intellectual capital of our faculty and the great work they do and the research they do. And I think we're in a period of time that's probably one of the most historic in times that certainly we can remember. It's being talked about as equal to a period of economic crisis that maybe perhaps expands all periods of modern history. And so I thought it would be a great idea, and it might be some interest if we heard from our great faculty on this topic. And we were also fortunate enough to invite one of our leading alums from Wall Street who was intending to be here today, and then because of the circumstances in New York, basically said, you know, I can't be here. But I'm very pleased that Hans Stoll and Jacob Segui and Craig Lewis have agreed to spend a little time today and give their perception, and Bill Christie's going to moderate this august group. So let's get started, Bill.
Okay, thanks. I think you might know our panelists, but let me just kind of remind you one more time of who they are. We'll start off here with Jacob Segui.
Associate Professor of Finance. Jacob joined us a little over a year ago from Berkeley. And the other great thing about him, he's Canadian as well. Hans Stoll, past president of the American Finance Association, really the leader who helped build the finance group. He's the reason a lot of us came here to begin with. So we're delighted to have him be able to help us figure some of this out. And Craig Lewis, Matt Wigginton Professor of Finance, came in around 85. So we have dozens and dozens and dozens of years of experience of the faculty here to be able to help us sort through this. And what we decided to do was give basically each of the panelists a few minutes to kind of give their own perspective on, you know, what happened? How did this happen? How can it be fixed? And it looks like it's about to be fixed. CNN just announced that the House and Senate have come to terms of a bailout. So maybe they should have waited a few hours to listen to the panelists before they did that. But we'll go ahead with Jacob to begin with. Then we just really want to open it up to a Q&A and answer any of your questions. So Jacob, take it away.
Thanks. So I thought what I'd do is I'd give just a very brief, an oversimplified overview of how the crisis came to be, and leave a lot of other details to my colleagues and the audience. So this is entitled A Tale of Three Economic Conditions and Two Regulatory Shortcomings. I'll try and focus on these. Let's start with the economic conditions that I want to talk about. Well, you won't be surprised to learn that declining interest rates were an important ingredient in all this, and another important ingredient was the increasing real estate prices, both more or less really coming together in concert since 2001 plus. Now, the thing about declining interest rates was that they caused institutional investors to develop an appetite for high-yielding but safe investments. The idea was for them to borrow short-term using the cheap interest rates, the low interest rates, and then invest in high-yielding but safe long-term securities. Okay, so what does that have to do with increasing house prices? Not yet. The thing about increasing house prices was that together with the lower rates, you have encouragement for a lot of borrowing against real estate assets and even potentially under harsh terms. The idea being that even if you borrow under harsh terms, if real estate prices keep going up, then it's okay. You'll make money in the end anyhow. Well, the thing is that normally risky loans are not safe investments. So how do you connect the financial institutions with all of this mortgage borrowing? And this is where the third economic condition fits in, and that's financial innovation. And what financial innovation allows us to do is create safe securities from risky securities. Okay, and that presumably feeds the insatiable demand of our hungry financial institutions there for investing in long-term safe investments by borrowing short-term. So those of you who have no idea how that magic takes place, how we take risky securities and turn them into safe securities, so here's a one-minute tutorial on CDOs. Well, So say we've got 100 of you in the room. I dare say there might be a few more. But say we have 100 of you in the room, and each of you gives me a dollar. Although the chance that any one of you might not pay it back could be high, you might think that the chance that all of you not paying me back, or a significant number of you not paying me back, is very, very low. And if I could convince myself that somehow I'm 99.99% sure that at least I'll get $90 out of all of you, then what I can do is I can turn around and sell a bond of $90, and it will be a very safe bond. And that's this piece up there that the hand is holding. On the other hand, what's left over is the very, very risky portion, because I'm not really certain I'd be able to recoup the other $10, and that's the riskiest portion of the so-called CDO, and sometimes it's called toxic waste. So the idea, again, is you take a... the idea is sometimes is you take a lot of these risky securities, you pull them together, and if you're pretty certain that you're going to get at least some of it paid out, then you can sell that portion out, and it's considered very safe. And that's how financial innovation was able to feed this insatiable demand of financial institutions, and the source really was all of these, say, risky loans that were taken out. Now, this here will give you, this gives you a depiction of just how much of that risky stuff was going on. In other words, how much risky fodder was there to feed the insatiable demand. And what we're seeing here is that 2005 and 2006 put together, there was about $1.2 trillion worth of risky subprime loans that were taken out. And the idea is that you put them in these pools, and then you separate out, you sell the safe part to financial institutions. Now, this is only representative of what was going on, because this was also happening with credit cards, auto loans, student loans, commercial real estate loans. In fact, even toxic waste from other pools were pooled together to form new pools. These things were called CDO squared. And basically loans from just about anything you could put together and therefore feed that demand for financial institutions to borrow short-term at cheap rates and invest in so-called safe long-term investments. So those were the economic conditions. Now to the what I characterize as two regulatory shortcomings. Well, one is that these yield-hungry financial institutions were building up huge balance sheets worth of these so-called safe assets, and they were financing them short-term. So they built up extreme leverage, all based on revolving door short-term financing. And in order to secure that short-term financing, what they would do is take those safe long-term assets and they would put them up as collateral in order to get the short-term loans. And the profits they made on this stuff were astronomical. I think maybe about as late as a couple of years ago, I think it was estimated that 40% of corporate profits in the U.S. were coming from the financial sector. That's unprecedented. All right, and so the issue is you've got unregulated financial institutions, extreme leverage, all relying on short-term lending based on collateral that was made up of these really strange-looking assets. And so we had here, because of the massive scale, you have the potential for a lot of financial fragility. The second regulatory shortcoming had to do with the fact that these securities that I just described, these so-called CDOs, were really quite opaque. And that's why I put safe here in quotation marks, because nobody really knew how, I mean, they were so involved in some instances that it was very difficult to trace back the history of where the loans came from and how the defaults might interact with each other, or what's the actual likelihood that these things will go down. And so you have a lot of potential for mispricing of risk on a massive scale. And it's really the massive scale, in my opinion, that was calling out for regulation, massive scale of what was happening on both of these sides. You've got these institutions borrowing short-term on a massive scale, and you've got these, everything is based on these opaque securities. Okay, so how do you get a credit crisis out of this? Well, as long as all of these weird securities are actually paying out, then everybody's happy. The problem was that when house prices started to decline, we started to see defaults. And we're starting to see defaults all at the same time, a lot of them. This wasn't supposed to happen, at least according to the people that put together these securities. And so we even started to see some securities that that were supposed to be a lot safer than subprime starting to go down. And so it created an atmosphere where nobody knew anymore what's actually really safe when it was labeled safe and what was not really safe even though it was labeled safe. And in particular, these institutions that were borrowing short term and putting up these so-called safe securities as collateral, well, nobody would accept these things as collateral anymore because you didn't know what they were worth. But they're dependent on short-term financing. And so they started to go down because they couldn't post collateral. They couldn't finance their balance sheets using all of that stuff that no one any longer trusted. And institutions like, for instance, Northern Rock, Bear Stearns, Lehman, they were all pretty much part of the same package. They came down because they weren't able to finance short-term a lot of their balance sheet. You also had regular commercial banks that were heavily involved with these kinds of securities. They may not have had as much of a leverage, but what ended up happening is that now that so much of these securities were in doubt on their balance sheets, they couldn't lend as much anymore because banks are supposed to hold back some of their assets as essentially insurance against things going bad. And so, of course, that dries up the market for credit. Now, more recently, what we're seeing this expressed as a commercial paper crisis. We're seeing a lot less ability for just regular corporations to go and borrow short term. Why? Because the big banks won't lend them. Why? Because their assets are tied up. In addition, we also have bond insurance starting to lose money. Why? Because some of these CDOs were actually insured. They had their credit enhanced by all kinds of insurers, so they're starting to lose money hands over fist. We also have insurers on actual companies dealing with these things called credit default swaps. In other words, they were selling insurance on defaults, and these kinds of insurance companies were essentially starting to lose money too. AIG is another example of that. So that is, in a nutshell, very brief, but an overview of what happened. And again, I'll say that in my view, in large part, we're talking about three important economic conditions that had to be there, plus a couple of regulatory shortcomings. So I'll shut up and let my colleagues go.
Thank you very much, Jacob. Hans, do you want to take a few minutes?
Can I sit and do this?
You sure can.
I think Jacob covered most everything. I don't know. I thought I'd try to compare this with some historical crises. I guess I'm the oldest here. I can remember most of these historical crises. And what's different about today's situation from earlier situations. First, maybe a little analogy to what's common to all these crises. Two guys are hiking in the forest, trudging along. Come to a clearing. The opposite side of the clearing is a grizzly bear. One guy gets down, takes off his hiking boots, puts on his sneakers. The other guy says, "You don't think you can outrun that grizzly bear, do you?" He says, "No, I can't, but all I have to do is outrun you." That's kind of like most of these financial crises. You want to get out the door while there's something left before the other guy gets out of the door. So there are runs on banks. You want to get your money because if you wait too long, there may not be any left to get. And it gets really serious when the bear is imaginary. You think there's a bear there, you get out the door, and that's a real financial crisis when, you know, there's no good reason for it. And so the regulators have to figure out some way to convince people that the bear isn't there, they don't need to run out the door, their money's safe, etc. So let me just make a few comparisons. The crash of Great Crash, people still talk about it as the Great Crash of 1929, which was a stock market crash. On Monday, October 20, all these things happen in October, by the way, so wait till October arrives, we're in deep trouble. So October 28, the stock market fell, I think something like 12%, and October 29, it fell another 12%. That was the Great Crash of 1929. From the perspective of analogy, perhaps more important is the run on banks in the early 30s, which occurred in that period. And it's a great failing of Fed policy to not handle that run on banks in the 30s properly. The money supply, the liquidity of the economy dropped by one-third in this period. I think Ben Bernanke remembers that, not that doesn't remember it, he wasn't there either, but he's a student of the history and doesn't want to let that happen again, doesn't want the liquidity of the economy to drop off. And he's tried, I'm not sure he's been successful in it yet, to be sure there's enough liquidity in the economy. Today's world is a little different. In those days, banks were the main component of the financial sector. Today, we have investment banks, we have money funds, we have other kinds of financial intermediaries. And so the task is broadened. You need to deal with investment banks as well. And so the Fed has broadened its outlook and doesn't necessarily have all the legal authority to deal with the other ways in which the economy is financed. But in its actions in the Bear Stearns merger purchased by J.P. Morgan and making a loan at that point, I think illustrates the willingness to consider broadening the way liquidity is provided to the economy. The crash of 1987 was a tremendous wrenching event for those people who were there on the floor of the stock exchanges. Again, it's mainly a stock market phenomenon. It didn't affect the credit markets like the current financial crisis. 1987, it was October 19th, the market fell on one day 22%. But it took 2 days in 1929, it took only one day in 1987. So our markets were quicker in one sense. That crash of 87 was blamed, I think, incorrectly on one of the great financial innovations in the last, how long is that, 25, 30 years, derivatives, index futures, and the process of index arbitrage and so-called portfolio insurance was said to worsen this crash of 87, to cause it. The idea was index futures traders in Chicago would sell index futures, driving down futures prices, and index arbitrageurs who linked the two markets, the futures market in Chicago to the stock market in New York, would pull down stocks. Now, I think the index futures traders were just acting on their assessment of the economic situation. What happened in that period, Jacob talked a little bit about the role of interest rates. Interest rates rose, long-term interest rates rose 2% prior to the crash, and the market didn't move. If you have a permanent 2% move in long-term interest rates, the effect on the stock market is about what we saw in the crash of 87, the 22% drop on Monday. By the way, prices had dropped prior to that for about a week, so the total drop from October 16th or 13th, something like that, to October 19th was about 30%. So that certainly was a crash in terms of stock market effect. It was much more severe than anything we've seen in this current crisis. The current crisis is quite different. It deals with the credit markets, the banks, short-term credit market and the like. The stock market has only recently been involved as the lose confidence in the future economic prospects for the economy and the lack of lending by banks. Another great crisis in recent history was the Essen loan crisis of the 1980s. By and large, that crisis came out of the tremendous increase in interest rates in the early 1980s. Savings and loans, borrow short and lend long, a fortiori is something that Jacob talked about. And when they had long-term mortgages outstanding, at 7%, and short-term interest rates rose to 20%, they had to pay 20% to finance their long-term mortgages, and that, you know, just doesn't work. And so over time, many of them failed. And there were many scandals as well and other issues involving the SNLs. But by the late 1980s, there are still so many of these SNLs hanging around that hadn't cleaned up their balance sheets and were really underwater, although you couldn't tell it because of the accounting situation. The Resolution Trust Corporation came in and cleaned up the mess and shut down these SNLs. So one of the issues is that we might discuss more is this so-called bailout plan that the bill indicated just had passed. Is that right? Had passed the proposes something similar, not actually to shut down these banks that have the bad assets, but to go ahead and buy those assets. What prices we may want to discuss that, but so there's a similarity to the Resolution Trust Corporation of the that dealt with the SNL crisis. But that SNL crisis was not an widespread financial markets crisis. It really was dealt strictly with the SNLs, and we didn't have sort of the run on the banks that we've seen in this current crisis. Another crisis which bears some similarity, and perhaps more, and it wasn't nearly as severe, was the credit crisis, long-term capital crisis of 1998, when credit spreads widened dramatically to, let's say, BAA over governments of 2.5 to 3%. This is where this famous long-term capital management lost a lot of money and had to be taken over by a variety of investment banks, famous because two Nobel laureate finance professors were part of that group. They felt that credit spreads were wide when they got into these arbitrage positions and that they would narrow. Instead, the credit spreads widened, and they got into a real pickle. So credit spreads today are also quite wide. But what's unique about the current crisis is the dislocation in the short-term credit markets, money markets. Does anybody know what the Treasury, 3-month Treasury bill rate was last week?
Negative.
Not quite negative, I don't think, but about zero. So, was it negative?
Very briefly.
For an hour, okay. So that's a little unusual. And so Treasury bills, flight to quality, and perhaps also attempts, that's the way the Fed implements its monetary policy, were reduced considerably relative to the interbank rate, the LIBOR or Fed funds rates. Some of these interbank rates were quite high because nobody wanted to lend money to another bank. The bank might go under. So there's a lot of concern, credit risk, in what we normally consider as a very safe interbank market. So this crisis that we're in is much more broad-based in some sense than some of the preceding crises, which focused on the equity markets and a reassessment of the value of stocks. We've got real issues with regard to the viability and strength of our financial system. Like the crash of 87, there are some new financial instruments that are popping up in this current crisis, these credit default swaps, which really bets on whether credit risk, whether somebody will default or not, these collateralized mortgage obligations. So there are a lot of kind of new instruments, and Jacob really gave a good summary of those and the issue of transparency and figuring out what's really going on is made difficult because they're over-the-counter instruments, and there's not the kind of disclosure that you would have as if it were traded on the stock market or traded in the futures markets. So let me leave it there and to turn it over to Craig.
Thanks, Hans. All right, so
I thought what I think Jacob did a really nice job summarizing sort of the landscape for some of these credit derivative products, and also explained the facts that what's happened in the markets. And I thought, given that as sort of an introduction, what I might do is tell a little story, if you will, about how moral hazard problems actually contributed to a credit bubble, and how that credit bubble eventually led to some of the financial crisis we see at some of the investment banks. So I begin the story by noting that there has been a large increase in sort of the amount of funds that are available to invest worldwide. And a lot of countries have developed. You take like Brazil, India, China. They've created an incredible amount of wealth over the past 10 years. And there's a lot of desire on the part of these investors to diversify their portfolios, to find investments. And a very attractive investment by historical standards has been the U.S. housing market. If you go back 70 years, it's had basically a steady run up. It's not incredible returns, but it doesn't have a down period over that time. And so that creates a demand to find ways to invest in the U.S. housing market. And it's not going to be a direct investment, but it can be an indirect investment. And I think credit derivatives offer these investors, as well as other hedge funds in the U.S. and other domestic investors, an opportunity to participate in that market. And so the demand for credit derivative products outstripped the available supply. And so early on in the development of the CMO markets, to take that as an example, what you found is that banks were applying normal lending practices, they were screening customers, they were being vetted, and they were making what you would consider to be high-quality loans. As that market heated up, the supply of potential borrowers who would be considered normal credit quality borrowers dried up to a certain extent, and it didn't, but there was still a demand for the product. So investment banks responded to that additional demand for credit derivatives by offering loans to progressively weaker borrowers with lower credit quality scores. And at one point, they were offering loans, they were called NINA loans, where it was no income, no assets. Basically, if you had a credit score, you were going to get a loan. And I saw one anecdote where an investor, a borrower, had 3 part-time jobs, gross income of $45,000 a year. He qualified for a $545,000 loan on his home. So to say that the credit quality was lax is an understatement. And so what did this do? Well, it led to a situation where you were making loans to people who were lower quality. The investment banks were still purchasing these pools of loans from commercial banks and creating these credit derivative products. So the net effect, though, is that you put a lot of money into the system. You put a lot of money that could be used to go out and buy houses. And so what happened is that excess supply of borrowed funds created a bubble, if you will, where housing prices, it was so easy to qualify for a loan that there's a lot of people buying houses, and it essentially resulted in prices that were selling above what you would consider to be historical fundamental value. And it created the possibility for there to be kind of a pullback. So prices went above what you would normally expect them to do. And at some point, the realization hit that that was going on. Now, in the back of this, you have investment banks who were basically packaging these products and selling them. And when investors like China are buying these things, they're not looking for the toxic waste that Jacob described. They're looking for the AAA credit pieces. And so what was happening is that the investment banks, trying to meet this demand, were unable to sell the lower quality pieces of these CMO pools and CDO pools, and they were forced to take them onto their own balance sheets. And so you had the investment banks holding significant pieces of their portfolios or their assets in these relatively low quality, high risk plays and speculations, essentially the real estate market. And so why does that contribute to the financial crisis? Well, it contributes to the financial crisis because investment banks are highly levered, right? Basically, you're going to find that at the time, the most banks are at ratios of 30-to-1 leverage. And so when you have a piece of your asset, when you have a significant chunk of your assets on your balance sheet being exposed to real estate markets, when there's even a fairly modest drop in prices, housing prices, that's going to feed through to the balance sheet and cause dramatic drops in the values of these portfolios. When the portfolios drop in value, there are going to be additional capital calls, and what you end up finding out is that these banks are go basically into bankruptcy and run the risk of becoming insolvent. And so that is, I think, the link between sort of lax lending practices and how it feeds back into creating a financial crisis where you have a small drop in prices, the leverage effect at these banks really creates problems for the investment banks. And so there are just a lot of problems associated with, I think, moral hazard issues, sort of that weak lending practices is one example of sort of lax lending practices. But moral hazard issues exist in other areas. In particular, I think that the rating agencies, the credit rating agencies, have some culpability in this because credit rating agencies were giving these securities AAA ratings and were rating these instruments when, in reality, I don't really believe they were fully competent to handle the evaluation of these complicated derivative securities. They were using antiquated models to try and assess what type of default risk was really present, and they made simplifying assumptions that grossly underestimated how likely they were to default. And one of the biggest weaknesses in the way the rating agencies were modeling this was they were effectively assuming that most of these loans were independent of one another, when what we've seen is that they're highly correlated, and when everybody goes down, they go down together. It's just not one person losing their job that causes the loan portfolio to fall apart. It's the fact that market conditions essentially force everybody to face a problem at the same time. And so I think that's one of the big problems. And from a policy standpoint, when I'm looking forward, I think that one of the problems that we would be associated with what the government's actually doing today with the bailouts is it creates an expectation that they're going to step in to bail out banks in the future. And so one of maybe the best things that I think that was done was when basically they said, we're not going to help Shearson. You know, Lehman Brothers can fold and we're going to allow you to go bankrupt, because it did something to create an expectation that not everybody is going to be protected. But the fact that we bailed out AIG, that we're looking at finding ways to help even insurance companies, suggests that if you are going to get into these situations in the future, you might be, you know, I would put some high probability on the government helping me out, and that creates a long-term problem the way these banks operate. So turn that over, and Bill, throw it back to you if you would.
We want to open it up for questions, so let's first of all thank them all for their comments. So I'll just open it up with one question, and then we'll take it from there. We'll probably find out within a few hours what this proposed solution is that Congress is going to be proposing to the Treasury Department. Any thoughts? You know, what we've heard is this, you know, this $700 billion bailout, and the media really like to say it sounds like that $700 billion is just going to get flushed down a toilet somewhere. Is there a way to be able to invest that? And Hans, you kind of alluded to this in the sense of, is there a price that the shareholders, us, the taxpayers, can buy these assets at and actually expect to get a good rate of return?
You asking me?
Yeah.
Somewhat. Well, it doesn't have to be a bailout, obviously, because if you think of this as a fund which invests in undervalued assets and you buy these assets at a good market price and hold them for 10 years and sell them, you know, you might actually make a profit and pay back the money. I think that's highly unlikely. But Bill Gross has said this morning that he'd do it for free. He's the head of PIMCO, which is a well-known fixed income manager. But, you know, so much gets, when the government starts administering a program like this, even if they hire Wall Street managers, you know, a lot of money is going to be spent in running this program. So I have serious doubt that the taxpayer is going to get away scot-free here. I don't think it'll cost $700 billion, but it's going to cost a lot of money. The other issue is, will it work? And, you know, I'm not sure it will necessarily provide the level of liquidity that is needed in the economy. And there may be other ways to provide that level of liquidity by either making loans or something that's less drastic that involves less taxpayer cost. So I'm not quite sure, number one, whether it will work, or number two, whether there isn't a method that will work equally well or maybe better than this rescue plan. So I have some concerns about it.
Yes.
As the government goes back and, you know, kind of buys back these bad debts and this toxic debt, who gets to determine what those assets are worth and how much the government is paying for? Does anyone know how that's going to take place?
You will when you get your MBA and you. scary, isn't it? That's the problem. It's a good point because they're not easy to value, and you're going to, you know, you say, I offer to buy stuff that you're having trouble selling in the open market, so people will come to the government. They're proposing a reverse auction where people, banks will compete with each other as to how much they will take for their debt. But, you know, there are differences across these debt amounts, so it's not going to be an easy task.
Yeah,
but my colleagues may have some.
If I could add something, I think one of the real difficulties associated with pricing this type of security is trying to come up with a way to estimate the likelihood of default. If you're going back and you're looking historically at what the default rates have looked like, you think about the story I was telling earlier, where initially when the CMO pools were being developed, you were providing credit to relatively good borrowers that don't default very often, and now you have a bunch of securities that are defaulting because you've made loans to people that had no business getting a loan in the first place. How do you go about assessing whether and who is going to default and how likely they are to default? That, to me, is the key issue. There's no historical data on which to base that analysis, so at some level, it becomes a speculation. I don't really know. Jacob, do you have a sense for how they might actually go about and try to measure default when you don't have default instances because no one in this category has been able to borrow before?
Well, we do have models that try to take into account both housing prices, interest rate risk, and things of that sort to try and assess some of this. Traditionally, that industry has ignored some of these factors, which is why CDOs were mispriced to begin with. The risk here is that, again, in these reverse auctions that are being proposed, it's not as if you're putting grade A lumber up for sale in a reverse auction. In other words, with grade A lumber, everybody that puts the lumber up, it's the same kind of lumber, you can compare them. So if you get the lowest price on something, you know you got a good deal. Here, you've got a lot of things that are very, very hard to compare because they depend on so many different things that it's like playing whack-a-mole. And we know that they messed up the pricing of these things, that they forgot certain risk factors when trying to price them initially. And more likely than not, we're going to hire the same people who did the mispricing to begin with in order to be able to tell us whether these, you know, any two CDOs are comparable when they're both selling at 22 cents on the dollar. This is a big issue.
Bailout plan will be most successful if it never needs to be implemented. If this confidence is restored, without ever implementing that plan, that would be the greatest success. That's really what it's meant to do: is to restore confidence. And if it really does to restore confidence, maybe we don't have to use it.
Yeah.
Hopeful thinking, wishful thinking.
What are your opinions on mark-to-market accounting contributing to insurmountable paper losses that effectively cause the investment banks to be called on
their loans? Basically, the way you account for these is you have to make an estimate of what the change in model price has been, and then take that to your books, right? And so the issue would be, does that contribute? And I guess the way I would look at it is the damage has been done, right? And so all you're doing, in some sense, is saying you're not solvent, right? So does mark-to-market accounting contribute or exacerbate the problem, or is it just essentially telling you you have a problem and it's bigger? I'd be less inclined to say that that accounting is the cause of the problem. It's just simply the person bringing you the bad news. So I haven't fully bought into the accounting-based explanations. Those losses have been real losses, and they've occurred. It does trigger capital calls that if you didn't have mark-to-market accounting, you wouldn't have had to made, but maybe I would prefer to see those capital calls take place.
So the only issue, I guess, is whether you mark-to-market or mark-to-model. I mean, you may find the market is depressed unreasonably, and I'm not even sure what the accounting rules are with regard to mark-to-market versus mark-to-model. Any accountants here that want to comment on that?
Well, there's three levels in fair market value. So if you have a ready market, you mark to market. If you don't have a ready market, you mark to model. So market's preferred. There's a market.
Right. But if there isn't, so you mark them. So it's not as severe. You're not really forced to mark down as much as you would as the price at which you could sell these assets. You can mark to model when there's no ready market, which seems perfectly reasonable, right? You want to know what the truth is, and that's as close to the truth as we can get.
Assuming you have an incentive to tell the truth in that situation.
Actually, just to piggyback off that, it seems trying to determine what it should be marked down to, especially if you're looking at a depression in the market versus giving it over the term of some of these mortgages that may last a while. It seems like there's almost a little too much cause and effect that are somewhat unrelated between the market going down and defaults happening. Those two shouldn't necessarily cause each other. Maybe more of these bad loans that are causing defaults more than the market just happens to be taking a downward swing because there's no supply of housing. So I guess I just want to understand a little bit more about, is this really market to market bringing the bear into the room a little ahead of time? It may have actually kind of corrected itself.
It's hard to believe that by being more transparent, somehow, we're creating a major problem. It's as if we hide everything under the mattress and then bury our heads in the sand, it's not going to come and bite us. That just doesn't seem to be the right kind of approach to this. In other words, as Craig says, to blame the bearer of bad news. Markets aren't stupid. If basically they understand that something is happening because of an accounting rule, then they take that into consideration. And so really the question here is, do we want transparency or not? And if we have the transparency, markets can take that information and do with it as they would. So that's the efficient markets view. There you have it.
The Wall Street Journal recently had an opinion piece where they were blaming, I guess, some of these problems on the rulings that came out at the end of the last financial crisis in terms of separating research analysts from the rest of the investment bank. Partly because it separated the brain from the body, and partly because it decimated the ranks of research analysts. And they think if there were more of these smart people had been around, they may have seen the problem coming earlier. I guess, what was your opinion on that theme?
I don't think this was a problem with research analysts. It's a problem with risk management. And the issue with risk management is that in good times, you don't want to hear from these people because they're just spoiling your party, and then in bad times, you're blaming them. And so they have the worst job. In investment banks, and we actually had someone coming in from risk management at the conference a few months ago who said basically as much. I think what we're going to see in the future is a lot more reliance on risk management to actually tell us what's going on. So I'm not sure it's the Chinese wall between the research analysts and the rest of the firm. It's not the research analysts that do risk management. And the problem here was very much a risk management problem.
How these complex derivatives and how the legality of the Fed, and I assume the 33 or 34 Act of the SEC, they weren't empowered to enforce any regulation on them. How do you see that changing in the future without trying to hinder capitalism, with these banks and the creation of innovative products?
Well, you do need to do something about these over-the-counter derivatives products that are not regulated by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or the SEC. They come under the Treasury to the extent they're regulated. And it seems to me that we really need to increase the so-called transparency, have a open market, standardize some of these claims so they can be traded as on a futures exchange with daily mark-to-market, where you have to mark your losses and take your gains daily, where you know the prices, you know what you can get if you want to sell this security. So exactly how that market should be regulated and how that change should come about, I'm not sure. I think the market would really pose coming under the SEC jurisdiction or the CFTC jurisdiction. But the Fed, I think, has been working diligently to try to make some improvements. At the credit default market, there have been improvements in the clearing procedures. The Depository Trust Company has taken over a lot of the keeping track of these instruments, but there's still a lack of transparency. You're pushing in the right direction, and I'm not sure, though, which agency will end up doing it.
There's been a lot of dire predictions about what could happen if the bailout does happen and the bailout doesn't happen. Where do you most see?
State the question again. State the question again.
There have been a lot of dire predictions about what could happen to the market with or without the bailout, according to what folks thought the end game is, I guess, either with bailout or without
bailout. I'll take a stab at this. I think that I personally think that the bailout is necessary. And it's largely because the unwinding of these positions that would be required without the bailout and the potential for even more sort of panic selling into this market likely to cause many more of these banks to fail, right? And when the banks fail, when AIG fails, it affects a lot more than just sophisticated investors. It affects us, right? And because of that, I think that's why the Fed is stepping up and really trying to administer the process. So to me, is the bailout going to be, I guess, better or worse than we expect? You know, I don't really have an answer for that.
Well, the market did go up today on the news, I think. So the market has answered your question.
I was curious about how long it will be before you can tell whether a plan is beginning to work and what you'll be looking for.
Well, what I would look for is an improvement in the operation of the short-term money market. It's unprecedented, the dislocations in the interbank, short-term interbank market, and the unwillingness of banks to lend to each other, and the fact that the T-bill is down to zero. Those are signs of real problems in the short-term money market that go beyond, I think, the mortgage situation. So we need to restore confidence in our major financial institutions. And so when I see the short-term money market straightened out, I think we've had success, even though you may still be trying to handle these mortgage-backed securities that are and clean the books of those. I would hope that we can get the short-term money market straightened out before we get to that sooner than that. So that could be a year, or a half year, I hope, is what I would look for to get the money market straightened out.
Aside from the current bailout, with regard to the FDIC, how likely do you think a federal bailout is of them with the increasing dependence on depositors to create liquidity within the banks? And if not, do you think that
what I understand is that after the bailout of IndyMac, the FDIC will have something like $50 billion left over. The head of the FDIC, at least at the end of June's report that they release, seems to suggest that things are not looking good overall, but they're not horrible. Like, for instance, I think they have a list of something like 117 banks out of, I think, something like 8,000, but 117 banks that are on their watch list. They don't tell you which one so that you don't go out there and grab your money out of there. But there are about 117 or so banks. This is up from maybe 90 about 6 months ago. This is nothing compared to, for instance, what it was during the S&L crisis. And even if the FDIC does need to have its funds shored up, this happened again before with the during the S&L crisis. So right now, I think what we're seeing is that non-performing loans are a little bit higher than the normal, but it's nothing to the extent that would have us all panicking yet. And again, you have to remember, during the S&L crisis, I think something like 1,300 banks were taken over. I think in the past year, maybe, I forget, nine? That happened to about nine. So we're still a distance away from having the bricks and mortars banking system about to evaporate.
We have to get everyone back to class here at 2 o'clock. So thank you all for your questions, and thank the panel.